I learned recently, because we watched the eclipse, more on that in a few weeks.
This week on Friday.
That eclipses are longer than I thought they were. I guess every instance in movie or TV where an eclipse has been seen, in my mind, is like, well, it's happening, like, it's just like a minute, right? Like, it's quick.
The moon will slide into place extremely quickly, then stay over the sun as long as necessary, and then slide off the sun as quickly as possible.
And I guess I just, like, internalized that a lot more than I thought, because we were watching the eclipse, and I'm like, this is going for a while.
Yeah. The partial eclipse lasts, like, an hour and
a half. We've been out here for, like, an hour, and it's barely, like, a little nibble.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. I am Blue, and I'm drinking a nice cup of Japanese sencha tea, and I'm joined by Red. What is your drink order today, Red?
He sniped me, everybody.
I gotta do it once.
I had a big thing of tea, and then I drank it, so I was like, you know what? I gotta use some of these cold brew ice cubes that have been sitting in my freezer for 3 weeks. So if I slowly get more energized and chill over the course of the podcast, you guys know why. Save me cold retreat.
Great. We came back from the eclipse at time of recording a week ago today.
Yeah.
And we're all still recovering from it.
Amazingly, none of us seem to have gotten sick, but just wiped mostly. Although I am still slightly recovering from hanging out with Cleo for a week and then wearing those clothes for 2 more weeks, because I am, as we've discussed, allergic to cats. So,
doubtful.
It's good. I'm suffering a little bit.
How could anyone truly be allergic to Cleo?
Yeah, right? She's so lovable and wonderful and squeezable.
Well, for more on that, we're going to have a video up next week on the channel, so we'll be able to talk about that in the next episode of the podcast. But this being this episode of the podcast, we got to talk about the shit we did last week.
Technically, it's this week. Technically, the thing that's going up is this week.
You know? Fair.
Yes.
But
that is what language means.
We move along. Yes. Red, you had a video on how Loki almost killed everybody again, otherwise known as the myth of Ethan's apples, and I had a detailed diatribe on Shadow of the Colossus. Where do you want to start us off?
We can start with mine. It's nice and short.
All right.
Because, man, that Loki, what a prankster, making me mix up C and BC in my script and then making sure that two separate people didn't catch it on the
I can't believe that Loki would do that to you.
Yeah, how could Loki do this? But yeah, no, it was a fun little number. It's always nice when I could just go, like, here it is in the prose edda. Here's what the story is. Let's discuss. And in this specific case, it was a pretty simple number. Very classic formula for Loki. Loki causes a problem and then gets strong-armed into fixing it. We love a good reluctant hero's journey. And what I love about this one is that he so desperately does not want to be there for any of it. He doesn't like doing this. He doesn't like having to do this. He doesn't even like causing the problem in the first place. He's not like, yes, bleh, my evil scheme. He's like, this is somebody else's evil scheme and it sucks.
Yeah. Characterization of characters in mythology is sometimes on the deeper side, but I guess usually tends to, like, skew pretty loose. It's like, okay, this character has like one or two distinct traits and they're kind of firing those all the time in the myths, but this is an interesting myth because we really do get to see a lot of what's going on in Loki's head, where he clearly is aware that this shit keeps happening, but he expresses God, fuck, oh, not again, shit.
He does not want to be doing this. It's that, like, John Mulaney bit. I also do not want to be doing what I'm doing. It is interesting to me that Loki is the butt of the joke more often than not. And even in cases where he kind of takes the initiative on doing the bad thing, usually the cartoonish price he pays is far disproportionate to whatever he did, with the key exception of the whole Balder thing. Even then, like, everyone else was playing the throw weapons game. The implicit aim was to try and injure Balder. Haters just can't stand to see a girl boss winning, I guess. Anyway, Loki's great. He's so fun. He's truly, if you ever watched the Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons and thought, why doesn't he just use those monies to pay for a pizza? Loki in the mythology will give you the exact same like mental whiplash every time he pulls some shit. And this one was fun because Ethan, I mentioned this a ways back when I did the Loki's wager myth, but the sons of Ivaldi are sometimes referred to as, oh God, I can't remember their father's name. But basically there's like certain attestations where like, yeah, they're Ethan's brothers. Ethan is the dwarf's sister. And I was like, great, I'll make her kind of look like them. So this is also the primary motivating impulse behind my hot dwarves agenda. Because it's like, oh, Ethan's a fair goddess. It's like, so her brothers probably also, right? Like, nobody ever said they had to be, you know, like short little, like, mountain people. Anyway.
Brothers are out there slamming on the regs.
Pain.
I waited until you were sipping from your coffee.
It's not going to wake me up at all if we keep doing these shenanigans.
On the subject of John Mulaney bits, this myth really did give me the impression that Loki is like, I was over on the bench. This dwarf comes by trying to steal Eden's apples, and it's like, wow, Loki, this is your fault. And I'm like, but I was just over on the bench.
Yeah.
Bad John Mulaney impression.
It was a Jotun, to be fair. The dwarves did nothing wrong in this story, and in most stories, I think Andvari.
Did I say the dwarves? Exception. I meant the giants.
You did,
I'm stupid.
Yes.
Okay.
It's fine. I thought that it was a very interesting little number, and it's always fun to me when they do this sort of, like, shapeshifter battle kind of thing, because, like, obviously the craziest shapeshifter battle I got to illustrate was when we did the Journey to the West episode at the end of last year.
Yeah,
because
no
that one was
that.
A literal like shapeshifter showdown of
kaiju
like, oh,
fight.
Yeah. Well, it culminated in the kaiju fight, but it was like, oh, you're going to turn into this kind of bird, then I'm going to turn into the kind of bird that kicks that bird's ass. Oh, you've turned into a nimble deer. I'm a tiger now. Fuck you. Just so fun. Whereas this one was like, he's a big scary bird, and I'm a little not scary bird, and I'm just doing my best, man. Just. Oh man,
when the saucer eyes really sold that frame.
When I was drawing the frames, I was like, normally I give Loki a little bit more banter, but like when I'm getting in his head for this one, I think it's just like, no, why?
Yeah.
Loki just having a bad week, even by Loki week standards. Top tier comedy.
You imagine everyone in Asgard's like, after everything resolves and they're not going to die of old age. It's like, okay, that was pretty funny, though. Like, yeah, we were all in danger of dying and our bones were falling apart as we were just sitting there waiting for Loki to hopefully save us. But, like, pretty good comedy.
Pretty good comedy, yeah. Jeez. No, it was a very, very interesting little myth. And I'm glad to have covered it. And I think Adam, Ludo History, mentioned to me that there's actually evidence that it's a quite old story, which I'm always fond of, but it's always so weird to me that the stuff about the mortality of the Norse gods is, like, old school. Because, like, there's evidence that the Ragnarok myth significantly predates the Christianization of Iceland and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was based on, basically, it's just linguistics and certain kinds of like pronunciation and rhyme schemes and poetic constructions that would only make sense if they were written before a known vowel shift around the year 1000. So we can basically backdate what poetry was written before or after certain points in time based on linguistics. And there's new evidence that can potentially pinpoint it to more specifically, like between like 965 and 985 or something, but that's in the field of modern debate. But yeah, a potential of Ragnarok and Völuspá to be way older than we would have first assumed is wild. But sorry, Red, continue.
Oh, sorry, I keep bouncing my mic for some reason. Well, that's really rad. I was reading through Children of Ash and Elm, and they had this very interesting little segment about how the exact steps of Ragnarok described align with pretty much every apocalyptically major volcanic eruption that Iceland had been dealing with for the last several hundred years, which is one of those things that is fascinating from the context of pre-Christianization. This is an act of religion. The gods are, you know, worshipped, yada, yada, yada. And there's a story of how they're all going to die. And it looks like this thing that we remember having happened. And then, from the post-Christianization cultural context, these are the gods we used to worship, and they died in this fiery conflagration that looks like this thing we all remember happening in, you know, 800-something, and 700-something, and 500-something, and yada yada. So, I don't know, I just think that's interesting. But it was odd to me, because, like, every time you look at something like this, like when you're reading through the Book of Invasions and there's all this stuff about like these were wizards and normal ass human beings who here's the family tree that makes them descendants of Noah, and it's like, yeah, sure, I 100% believe that was the way that the Irish religion worked at the time. Like, come on. But then you get something like this where it's like the gods are mortal in the most literal sense. They can age and die. And you're like, yeah. Well, that smells a little funky. But it's like, no, seriously, we actually believe this. So, yeah.
And it would kind of weirdly make sense as being unique to the original, you know, Norse cultural space, as opposed to something that was brought in later, because the idea of you know, like in the Mediterranean world, you know, Greek gods don't really age and die. Christian gods do not age and die, at least not permanently. That it does kind of make sense that the Norse, you know, culture would have its own interpretation of what divinity looks like.
Yeah.
Especially considering that there are all kinds of, like, almost divine characters. It's like, these are the Vanir, who are maybe also gods, maybe different gods, maybe not gods. It depends on how you read the text.
Oh, yeah. Everybody fights over that. There's...
Yeah.
I didn't even touch that when I was doing the Nine Realms video. Because, of course, because Vanaheim is like, it gets brought up a lot, you know, the place of the Vanir, but, like, any details? No. And every time I looked into this, I would find myself immersed in this, like, decades-deep slap fight that basically boiled down to... Are the Vanir like the older natural wild gods and the Aesir gods of civilization? No! Smack! It's just like, it's only ever that fight. I think there were a couple other interpretations, but it usually boiled down to, well, perhaps the Vanir represent an older, more in tune with nature. And I've seen stuff like this in Greek mythology, too, because there's this general idea that, like, a lot of the gods whose origins are in Arcadia are from this, like, older, more animalistic, wild religion. And it's like, yeah, maybe. But I'm a little sus at how frequently we keep coming back to that idea, because it kind of feels like it's coming from the same place as, like, back when we all lived in caves and wore leopard skins, and it's like, no, that doesn't seem to have been how that worked ever.
Ancient civilizations had a much less firm divide between the sophisticated urban world and the scary, terrifying, like, rural woods. Because, like, even in, like, ancient Greece, the concept of a city is literally an urban core and then farmland. Yep. The concept of a city has both of them in it already.
Yeah, and in ancient Greece, it took time before Apollo and Artemis kind of settled into the idea of Apollo lives in the cities, Artemis lives outside of them, and together they cover basically the entire world. But
that's basically a Roman idea at that point, right?
Yeah. As far as I can tell, it doesn't seem like that specific form of, like, dualism was really popular before Rome started getting their mitts all over it. But, like, anytime I see a framework like that, that's like, there was a previous generation of gods, or, like, the oldest of the gods are, like, they're the ones that were worshipped in, like, trees and caves, but now we build them temples. It's like, I don't know. Like, I understand why that idea is appealing, and that's why I'm suspicious of it. Because, as we've discussed, the most dangerous instinct anywhere in this is, yeah, that could make sense.
That tracks.
Yeah. I could see that, and it's like, yeah, but I want evidence, please.
Yeah. This is a case of, I see the council's made a decision, but given it's a stupid-ass decision, I've elected to ignore it.
This is why the depths of this form of academia really freak me out. It's more fun to just read the originals, tell the story again in a goofy way, and then call it a day, because the deeper you get into it, the more you're, like, uncertain of absolutely everything.
It also gets to the point where it stops being fun, but that's a much longer conversation for another time.
I'm sure the academics who've made this their life's work enjoy it, but, like,
having met a few,
me.
I don't know.
Oh, no. Oh, well, hopefully they're getting a kick out of it. Anyway, that was my thing.
Yeah.
On a much more recent ancient primeval source of yada, 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 your video.
Dorman's never hurt anyone who didn't deserve it.
Yeah. Dorman was unproblematically worshipped in the wild woods.
Dorman didn't kill those colossi. That's Wander. That was the cruel hand of urban society coming into the natural world.
Representing.
It makes sense.
Oh, yeah, that could make sense.
Yeah.
Dorman
yeah.
is a metaphor for society.
We live in one of those, you know. That's fucked up.
Oh, shit. God. It really makes you think, doesn't it? So you made a video about Shadow of the Colossus, is what we're saying.
I'm too busy contemplating the fact that we live in a society that's going to mess me up all day just thinking about that. Ugh. Damn.
At time of this going out, our supercut of our playthrough of Shadow of the Colossus is going to have gone up the previous day, I assume.
Yes.
Right? That's the yeah.
Yeah, it'll go up on.
Everyone's
it will have gone up
our,
on Tuesday.
Everyone's going to get to see our Wander Talarico bit.
Oh my God, that's I haven't gotten to that yet. I'm editing
You're
it.
You're not
today.
Allowed to cut it out now. I've spoken it into
yeah,
existence.
Yeah, no, it's staying in. No way.
Yes.
Red very kindly took all the original footage and cut it down into like a 50-minute supercut, and then I cut down to whatever the final time ends up being. Really excited for that one to come out. This video kind of came together, the Shadow of the Colossus Detailed Diatribe, on the quick side because we were hanging out after PAX, and I was like, I'm not going to be able to finish my next video in time if literally anything goes wrong, because I have just enough time for a regular video production schedule, and if anything messes me up, I'm screwed. We got to figure something out. So
yeah.
The emergency like ripcord purpose of the Detailed Diatribe coming in exactly as it was intended when we first kind of created the series. But I was really happy with how it turned out. The discussion was fantastic. We were able to basically play the game, record it, not realizing we were recording ourselves with audio. We thought we were
just
getting B-roll.
Like, yeah, we need B-roll because we're about to make a video about this.
Yeah.
And then after like the first video, it's like, oh, hey, it captured the audio from the built-in mic. Oh, all of our bits!
Yay, our bits!
Our bits!
Yeah, but we were playing it around Colossus number like 13 or 14, whichever one Celosia was.
I think it's earlier than that.
Or earlier than that, yeah.
Because Pelagia was after Celosia, or
right,
whichever.
Right, Pelagia's like...
Because there's the little guy with the 13. Fire, and then there's Pelagia, and then...
It's Phalanx after that.
Then Phalanx, right.
We get a treat.
I think the dickhead one might be 11.
Maybe.
But yeah. Anyway,
Synodia,
that was
whichever one it is.
The one where I got soft locked into a getting killed loop. Well, I mean, I wasn't getting killed. That was the problem. That was around the time where we were like, hey, wait a sec.
We figured out the seams of the game design.
A game that is perfect as long as you play it perfectly is not a perfect game. Shit, that's good. We could put that in the... No!
Yeah.
Inspiration strikes too late. My muse has sabotaged me.
It's okay. But we were able to figure out our thesis, record it very swiftly the next day, and then basically ship on out for what eventually took us to the Eclipse.
Yes.
So it came together very quick, but all things considered, I had a blast putting it together. The thesis that we were able to land on was very fun. And hearing so many people be like, oh my gosh, this game is so good, even so much time later. People talking about having played it, you know, originally in 2005 when it came out, people whose first experience was the new game, the variety of responses is always a treat for any video, but hearing people share their own experiences about Shadow of the Colossus was very fun, and seeing which Colossi people really liked and which ones people hated. Pelagia is nowhere near far enough down on the bottom of most people's tier lists. Maybe that's just an us experience.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think it's the fact is, we specifically have beef with any of the ones that have the potential to plunge you to the bottom of a pitch black lake. Well, there's like four of them, but a lot of them are decently manageable, you know? Like, even the fucking eel thing, once I figured out when I was reviewing the footage for the initial cutdown, it will dunk itself if you walk on its head, but not if you painstakingly crawl on its head. Why is it programmed like that? Who gives a fuck? It doesn't really matter, right? And I really respect that none of this is stuff that they polished up for the re-release. They didn't make it easy on you, because if they did, you wouldn't remember how annoying they were.
I watched a lot of behind the scenes like making of videos for the remake. After the video came out, because I was like, I want to see more Shadow of the Colossus stuff beyond the video that I just made. What else is there out there? And I learned that the way they, at Blue Point Games, made the engine for the new game is that most of it was running on the original PS2 code that was basically filtered through a new modern engine and then was like basically rendering everything out on, you know, like PS4 scale. But a lot of the Colossus AI is still the original stuff. A lot of Wander's behaviors are still the original stuff. And they added on layers of animation and polish. So like the cloth physics are new on Wander's tunic. Great. He will look at things in the world. If he gets close to like a lizard or like a point of interest, he'll look at something. He will look at a colossus when you're running around. He'll look where the camera's going. So they added all those things in the new engine, but a lot of the original code is just as janky as ever because they're just pulling straight PS2 code and doing a lot of post-processing work on top of it. So it was really cool to hear how they made it. And that goes a long way to explaining why it feels so realistic to the original game, because it is.
Yeah. I was thinking about this a little bit because this morning, actually, I just watched a video from Super Eye Patch Wolf, who I've seen some of their stuff. I don't watch them super regularly, but they did a video about the bizarre world of like fake video games, not in terms of like this is like a Kickstarter hoax or something, but like when people will release like a walkthrough guide for a game that doesn't exist. What? With like, you'll encounter this kind of enemy, or like this part of the game is set in this thing. And it feels completely baffling to say in that context, but oftentimes it's sort of like an ARG horror thing, or like it's describing kind of stuff. Yeah, kind yeah. of, or it's describing like this game that sounds like it would be absolutely miserable to play, but it's kind of telling you this interesting message about like slow acceptance of yourself or whatever. But one of the interesting points about it is that this is something that I was thinking about recently, because a lot of older games, the hardware was physically incapable of making it look like the game was supposed to look like. Like the original like Resident Evil games don't look scary, but you look at the like the booklet that comes with it and it's like the zombies look like this, and then when you get jump scared by like a pile of four polygons on the floor, you're like, oh fuck, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting that now that we've gotten to the point of like graphical fidelity where pretty much any video game on any major console can look how the artist wants it to look. Like, the pixel resolutions at this point are, like, sub-human vision at this point in a lot of cases. You can kind of just do whatever you want. But you end up losing this element of, like, here's the additional, like, lore booklet with all the concept art. Here's what this collection of pixels on the screen really looks like when it's rendered out, like original, like, Chrono Trigger, where I think that's the one where they got Akira Toriyama to do, like, all of the character art for it, and then on screen it's like 8 pixels, but it's like, but this is where the iconic slime looks like, man.
Or maybe Dragon Quest? But,
well, I think
yeah.
Dragon Quest was also Toriyama, but I think
yeah,
he also
that one I know
Chrono
is Toriyama,
Trigger.
Yeah.
Hold on, let me just, like, because I don't want to be wrong about this, but I think, oh yeah, Chrono Trigger is absolutely also Toriyama. He, okay. Mans was prolific. But but yeah, you know, I think it's kind of really interesting to think about where you get these old games where the graphics just physically couldn't do that stuff. But to make up for it, you would get all these like booklets and tutorial, like the manual would have little comic inserts where like Solid Snake talks to you to explain what's up or something like that, and it's like, yeah, and it is kind of a bummer that you don't really get that now because you don't need it anymore.
There is one element of the original game that did not need any instruction booklet to make more clear, that comes across perfectly even on old PS2 hardware, and that is the music, which is part of why the game still has such a strong identity all this time later, and why going to a concert, it's like, oh shit, there it is. It yeah. doesn't require any kind of fancy hardware. It is basically universal, and it is still so goddamn good. And I'm glad that most of the conversations we have about Shadow of the Colossus keep coming around to the music one way or another.
I gotta just re-listen to it all. It's like, so what good. Else am I doing with my life right now?
I listened to, or I watched a video by a YouTuber and composer named Alex Mukala, who's done a lot of work on a lot of cool stuff, but he had a video basically reacting to the Opened Way and the prologue music for the first time, and hearing him be like, oh my gosh, this is not only so, so good, but like, here's what they're doing to make it feel as good as it is, where it's like, there's this, and then this bass line comes in, I'm like, oh shit, Alex, yeah, that is really cool, great. So I want to learn more about this now. I finished the detailed diatribe, and there's so much more to go into. So I'll be scrounging for Shadow of the Colossus videos on YouTube for the next few weeks, surely.
Oh, you're not going to be scrounging for long. There's a full bounty out there, my friend.
Oh, yeah. I'll be eating well. Yes. But we got to move along to the next section of the podcast. But first, real quick, a couple of announcements. One, on the subject of Loki almost getting everyone killed, Norse pins for Freyr and Freya are still available in our Crowdmade shop for another a little bit less than a week till the end of this weekend. They are there, so you can go grab them. And also, next podcast episode, we'll be joined by a special guest, JM8 from Second Wind, creator of Design Delve. huge fan of the whole Second Wind gang, so we'll be very excited to have JM8 on the pod. If you have any questions for him, feel free to ask them in the Ask OS Pod channel on Discord. But with that, we can hop over to the Q&A portion of the podcast.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Q&A portion of the after. Oh my god.
Almost.
Ugh, I got a headache. traveling's fun, but it takes so much out of you. Yeah. This is the Q&A portion of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast, where we answer your questions from Ask OS Pod on Discord. This first question comes from one of our lovely patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, support the channel, consider becoming a patron for a chance to have your question read first on a future episode.
Perfect.
This question comes from Saturn Toodles. To all, in honor of the solar eclipse, what is your favorite solar eclipse in media? From the day of Black Sun in Avatar to the one in Castlevania Nocturne.
Those are my two examples.
They seem to always signal big events. So which is your favorite?
Hold on. Perfect.
Oh, nice.
What is your favorite solar eclipse?
I just was writing up preliminary notes about a potential trope talk on the stars have aligned trope. And a major subset of that is specifically eclipses, because it is probably the most obvious and prominent alignment of any sort of cosmic spheres that you can have. So I've been doing my fucking homework. But unfortunately, the objective correct answer is the promised day in Fullmetal Alchemist. And, you know, everyone else is just competing for second, which is fine. That's fine. There's no shame in that. But unfortunately, second place is the Owl House, which also has a promised day vibe for that. But I can't remember what they called it. Day of Unity, that's right. Which is a cheeky little double meaning.
Nice.
Yeah.
Day of Black Sun is probably my first eclipse in media, just because of how young I was when I watched Avatar for the first time. As it aired back in the trenches, getting made fun of in school for liking the show with the four elements getting thrashed around at each other. That and Bionicle, I got a lot of whatever.
The one with the six elements getting thrashed around at each other, but with
robots.
I'm
owning it now. I have exactly one mode. But Day of Black Sun is great because there's so much build up to it. It doesn't just happen. There's a lot of like plot points starting from the second season when they go to Wang Shitong's library. It's like, oh shit, this is a big ass deal. There's a lot of drama that goes into it, not just like, oh haha, suddenly an eclipse. Like the one of Hercules is like, the stars aligned, what does that mean? Fuck it. That's the Zeus's padlock has to like break open because Jupiter said so or whatever.
A plot point they also use in Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. Mm. But then the one in Castlevania Nocturne's fun. I'm excited to see what they do with it in the second season, whenever that ends up coming out. Mm-hmm. Because currently it's just, all right, Erzsebet Bathory's like, haha, you see, forever night, except that's not how long eclipses actually work, so it's going to be this one corner of France for like 30 minutes tops.
Well, no. The thing is, I've been mentally like categorizing them according to how well the writer is adhering to the rules of real eclipses in two key respects. One, narrow path of totality. Two, short window of eclipse. Erzsebet Bathory gets a pass because she is magically inducing an eclipse, but she cannot magically make the moon bigger, or it would not look like an eclipse. Because that's what makes it look like that. So either she's magically holding the moon in place, and this one corner of France under the moon shadow is experiencing eternal night, or she's making it night everywhere, and the effect that they're using is an unrelated solar eclipse. Which is why Fullmetal Alchemist's The Promised Day is the best, because it makes it a plot point that A, the moon's shadow is a small part of the Earth's surface, and B, it lasts a limited amount of time. So Day of Black Sun wins one of 2 points, because it's like, we're only going to have like 7 minutes to invade the Fire Nation, but it is kind of implied, like, does it look like a solar eclipse from everywhere? Like, is the solar eclipse just over the Fire Nation? Does it only, like, knock out benders in the moon path? What's up with that? Anyway, it's fun.
I think we're all sleeping on the real answer at the end of Avatar 2, The Way of Water, when the eclipse is, to my understanding, critical to the final battle. No, my real answer is Little Shop of Horrors, because the eclipse is what allows Audrey 2 to exist. And,
yeah, I kept seeing,
you know, it's got the fun
that
musical line. Great movie. You know, who doesn't love a little Rick Moranis moment? But go on. Every answer that's been given so far has also been a good answer. I learned recently, because we watched the eclipse, more on that in a few weeks.
this week on Friday,
that eclipses are longer than I thought they were. I guess every instance in movie or TV where an eclipse has been seen, in my mind, is like, well, it's happening, like, it's just like a minute, right? Like, it's quick. And
yeah, no, the moon will slide into place extremely quickly, then stay over the sun as long as necessary, and then slide off the sun as quickly as possible.
And I guess I just, like, internalized that a lot more than I thought, because we were watching the eclipse, and I'm like, this is going for a while.
Yeah.
Like, we've been out here for, like, an hour, and it's barely, like, a little nibble. Mm-hmm. But more on that in the future.
More on that on Friday.
Yeah, this next question comes from Vicky to Red. Throughout my teens and early 20s, I worked in a supermarket bakery. I got really good at mental math on the fly. I also had most of the codes for items memorized to the point where my coworkers would sometimes ask me instead of scrolling through the book. Now I'm out of the retail life, thank God, and my math skills have just died on me. Do you do anything to keep your math skills sharp?
It's not really a muscle I go out of my way to flex. I do occasionally do, like, little killer Sudokus just to make sure that I still know how to do arithmetic. Also, I use that as a little mental test to make sure I'm, like, lucid enough to safely drive on days where I haven't necessarily slept very well. I'll do a little killer Sudoku, and if my thoughts are disorganized enough that I make more than one mistake, I'm like, oh, okay, maybe take a little nap first. But I think it's a little bit less that I go out of my way to make sure I can still do math and more. I will occasionally stumble into math problems in the wild and my brain will just like hook into it and like gnaw on it. Actually, I think everybody on the call was privy at least a little bit to this, because when we were flying back from Iceland a year or so back, my brain noticed a math problem was happening, which is that we had been flying at sunset for a while, and I was like, hey, wait a second, how fast is the sun effectively setting at this point? Are we actually outpacing it? And I was doing the math of like the latitude, the effective circumference of the earth at our specific latitude, which was about 60 degrees, so something effective radius about 400. It ended up basically being that while at the equator the sun effectively moves at 1,000 miles an hour, at our latitude the sun was effectively moving at 400 miles an hour, and we were easily outpacing it in our commercial jet. But by the time we curved south enough to actually land in the U.S., it had reached the point where it was moving at about 700 miles an hour, and it very, very slowly gained on us until the sun set exactly as we landed. And that was just doing some fun little trigonometry. I keep like not forgetting the trigonometric formulas that you can use as shortcuts, or like for sine and cosine and tangent and stuff like that. So I kept having to like rederive them by just drawing out triangles and being like, okay, this angle, this one, yeah, this, that, okay, a squared plus b squared, okay, cool. But it's fun for me, because like I've always been of the opinion that memorization is the least important part of math, and rederiving things from first principles is kind of all you need, which is why every other hard science annoys the crap out of me, because you need to memorize shit and you can't rederive stuff from first principles. But that kind of quick and easy math is definitely a skill that you lose if you don't use it a lot, but also it's still there. It's just dormant, you know? you don't lose it forever, and the ability to break down a situation into a math problem and figure out how to solve it is, I think, a skill that never really goes away. It's just the specific tools you might find yourself a little bit clumsier using before you crack it open again.
I feel like the difference, and maybe this is a conversation I'm nowhere near well enough equipped to step into, but like math is basically always deriving stuff from first principles, but science is a constant search for first principles, right?
Yeah, basically.
Because like, isn't the whole problem of like chemistry and physics, like how small do those little particles really go?
It gets really fucking weird the further in you get. I think that it's a little bit distressing, because when I was like really in the sauce with my math degree, it's like, you know, you're doing proofs all the time and you can like see the code. It's like, oh, I need this, I'll bring in this formula and this concept. But really the muscle memory that you learn when, at least when pursuing the kind of math degree that I got, was very much like the skill set of taking something confusing and breaking it down into a problem, and then figuring out how to break that problem down into things that you know how to solve, and then putting all those solved pieces together into a greater solution. And even if you lose track of the individual tools for like, how do I reduce this down again? Like sine of like A plus B, there's a thing for that, but I can't remember what it is, like that kind of thing. You know, those are the things that you will forget if you don't use them regularly. But you don't need to. so much, you know, unless this is actually what you're doing for a living. It's the underlying muscle memory of, like, how to break the thing down that I don't really think goes away, and I don't think you need to go out of your way to practice, because you'll find it there lurking in your subconscious when you're confronted with a fun little math problem like that.
Yeah, that's kind of the secret to all academia, is, like, no matter what specifically you were studying, you can forget the individual little fun facts, but if you learn how to problem solve, you're probably never going to unlearn how to problem solve whatever the problem you're solving is. I was going to make a comparison to language.
Yeah. You forget vocabulary, but you remember the core grammar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Why, like, whenever I'm doing Greek stuff, like, I studied ancient Greek in college, and now I'm learning modern Greek, like, properly. And it's like, we come to this word, and I'm like, oh, God, how the fuck do you say that? But I know how to, like, decline the word correctly, but what's the fucking word?
Yeah, well, this next question comes from GhibliLover610 to Blue and Indigo. What kind of cats are Cleo and Ziggy when they're at the vet? Are they well-behaved? Are they overly dramatic? Are they angry and ferocious? You tell us. I gotta take Ziggy to the vet this week. She's on a diet, and she gets these little weight checks every once in a while, and she hates them. Like, it takes max door to door 10 minutes. The vet is on the same block as I am. Like, it's the most uninterruptive kind of adventure, and she doesn't even have to get, like, she's not getting any sort of medicine. She just has to stand on the scale for like 10 seconds and screams throughout the vet's office. I'll hear, because I'll be sitting in the waiting room, and Ziggy gets taken into the room with the scale. She gets mad, like, the second she sees the carrier come out from its place in the closet. Like, yeah. And then the minute I get home, she gets out of the carrier, and she's completely fine and normal. And I'm like, what do you want from me?
Ain't that the way?
I happen to know where Cleo falls on this.
Cleo is of two minds of vet trips. Usually she can be very well behaved. The vets are always like, oh my gosh, what a sweet little baby. She's so cute. She's so calm. But we had to get a routine blood draw from Cleo, just because, like, you know, she's a five-year-old kitty. Gotta, you know, get a good baseline stats in, so when she gets older, we know what to compare it against. But she was kind of like rustling and tussling a little bit, didn't want to get that blood draw, and it required the vet, two assistants, and Cyan, who was in the room, I was elsewhere that day, to hold Cleo down to attempt to get the blood draw, and even then she wriggled free, so the vet said, this is drugs, give this to Cleo, and come back, and she'll be high off her ass, and then hopefully she'll stay still for a sec. So we dutifully obliged, got Cleo whacked off her little ass, took her in, and then we were able to get the blood draw. Still with a little bit of difficulty, she is strong, she is a brawler.
She is strong, like the bull.
And then we brought her back home, and as she slowly came to, she realized that she had been drugged and was very indignant about it for the rest of the day.
Well, because, like, we went out to lunch while she was still high off her ass, like, pupils enormous, and then when we got back, she was just sitting by the front hall, very sullen. The narrowest pupils I've ever seen on her, you know, like fucking Smaug monologuing levels of menacing. And then immediately we're like, happy gotcha day. Here's a box full of catnip. And she was like, yay, more drugs. So
my vet also gave Ziggy like anxiety meds and stuff. They're like, this will help her, chill her out, so that when she comes in the vet, she's not, you know, like screaming and stressed. And I was like, great, no problem. Let me give Ziggy these doctor recommended medications. And I haven't done shit. She's just as loud and annoyed every time. She's like completely resistant to them. I'm like, Doc, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I got nothing here. Like, this cat just hates coming into this vet's office.
Amazing.
And she's so like, she's not, like, attacking anybody or nothing. She's just wiggling around, screaming her little head off. Ziggy's already a loud cat, but, like, screaming her little head off. I don't know. This is one of the great mysteries of the Ziggy universe, I guess. What she fears here. But we got more questions to get to. This one comes from Andrew to all. What is your favorite ice cream flavor? We've been getting some warmer weather in Philly, so let's ask some summer sweets questions.
I am a fan of most kinds of chocolate ice cream. Usually if there's like a double or triple chocolate on offer, I will go for that. If we can combo chocolate with like a raspberry is really good. Whenever I'm in Italy, my go-to gelato combination, or anywhere that has gelato. I'm not
blessed with
an abundance
of... Whenever I'm in Italy.
I'm not blessed with an abundance of places that have gelato by me. I've got my local crêperie, but it's not a gelateria.
I only get ice cream when I'm in Italy. Nowhere else.
That's the only place it's good, damn
except
it.
My local crêperie.
For those I'm of us the plebeians who have never been to Italy and don't have access to regular gelato supplies, ice cream.
Yeah,
though,
Ben and Jerry's pretty good usually.
Yeah, the chocolate therapy is great.
Do you like
no gelato. Fuck me.
Individual flavor-wise, I normally go to mint chocolate chip, but I will usually do like a combo of like chocolate ice cream and cherry if I can mix and match. I have a fondness for butter pecan that I tend to use like once every like three ice cream re-ups. I'll be like, oh, they got butter pecan. But the Häagen-Dazs Dulce de Leche is my general like go-to like thing I want to have in my freezer because it doesn't stay there for long.
This reminds me of a time when I was in a like a college program in high school, like a little summer course, and there was this one guy in the class. We all went out to get ice cream, and he was looking at the sign of flavors, and he's like, "Oh my God, they have douche de leche!" And everyone was like, "Fucking what?" He was mispronouncing dulce de leche as douche de leche. So whenever I see that, I'm like, "Yo, they've got douche de leche!"
Whoa, douche de leche all up in here. God, that's amazing.
Cursed.
Yeah. I like a good, like, black cherry. I used to be a big Rocky Road kid, but now I've sort of settled into my, like, black cherry if it's available to me. But there's some flavors that I feel like you just can't get everywhere all the time. Like, a key lime pie ice cream is elite. Mm. That's some of the best stuff you can get in a scoop. But that's not frequently accessible to me in most places. So, alas, I must pick a different flavor. But anything chocolate's going to be good, too. We finally
chocolate's
hit Rita's.
No douche delish.
We finally hit water ice season, which is my... summer dessert situation. But this next question comes from ScamLikely8045. To Blue, I just recently played through the whole Uncharted series and have slowly started to realize that my wardrobe has become a bit more similar to Drake's. Which game is your favorite, and where can I find good Henleys for the money?
This question is me from 7 years ago. Well, in order. I played through 2 first, went back to 1, then played 3, and then 4 when they came out. I haven't played Lost Legacy yet. I've been meaning to, but I haven't. I missed the boat when it came out. I had other stuff going on, and then I just never got back to it. But I have to put Uncharted 4 as my top.
Naturally.
It's the most complex and meaningful story of the bunch. After that, I like 2 a lot. It was my favorite of the original 3 when it was coming out, and it's just a good ass game. More thoughts in my Uncharted detail diatribe, but also further confirming that number 4 is by far my favorite. It's just so well done front to back. As far as where to get Henleys, I originally got a lot of my Henleys from Old Navy and Gap, but it's been a while, and I don't know if they're still good from there anymore, because it kind of changes sometimes. Like, companies get new suppliers, or you go to, like, one store to get something, and it's good, and then you go to, like, the same store, but in another place, and the quality's, like, weirdly different or worse. Mm-hmm. Modern fashion's a nightmare. But the Henleys that I've currently got are Waffle Knit from Old Navy, or no, Waffle Knit from Gap, that are, at this point, like, 2018, and they're still holding up all right. Got some wool Henleys from a company called Woolly that are all right. Better for some warmer clothing options if I need them. But I don't know. Fast fashion's a nightmare, and it's always kind of constantly changing, so I cannot give you an accurate read of where to get good Henleys. It was Old Navy, and then it was bad, and it was after that Gap, but I don't know what it's like now. So your mileage may vary. I remember having a very hard time finding Henleys back in the day, because for whatever reason, trends change, and sometimes it's like, this year, no one's stocking any of that. Mm. Have fun. Starve and die.
Refs at our boot cut conversation from
yes,
a previous
exactly.
episode.
Mm-hmm. So to answer, Uncharted 4, and then no goddamn idea, good luck. Get stuff in person, don't buy it online.
Well, this next question comes from Ada ? To all, exam season awaits us, insert the sobs of students everywhere. What is your worst test or exam story?
Oh, huh. It's not, I mean, this one feels like a humble brag, unfortunately. I was in a climate science course that I signed up for because I was like, whoa, climate science. I love this shit. I want to know more about it. I did like an independent study for it in high school. I want to know more. And I discovered by about class number three that what I was in was what I've heard affectionately referred to as physics for poets, which is when you're in a university that has a core curriculum and you need to take a science requirement, but there are people there who are not at all scientifically minded. They're not there to study anything. There will be classes, physics for poets, a class to get your science credit in that is not hard, that tests you to the book, open book, all that jazz. Our lecturer seemed very nice, but we were in a big auditorium. He talked directly into the blackboard, did not project out in the slightest, had a very thick accent that made it difficult for me to understand what he was saying. At some point, I realized, oh, I am learning nothing from sitting here. And he's pretty upfront about that. It's like, we're covering this chapter of the textbook. So we had a midterm exam. And the normal way that I test is that I will study the material, and then I will attempt to internalize it, understand it, and then when a question comes up on the test, I will attempt to formulate an answer from the knowledge I've absorbed and write it down, which got me about an 80 on the midterm. And a lot of the questions were phrased strangely, and I couldn't figure out why. And what I realized afterwards when he told everybody, okay, so the average score on that was a 60, but, you know, it's okay, we'll figure this out. Was that the questions that struck me as phrased oddly were essentially sentences from the textbook rephrased into questions. And the answer was the next sentence in the textbook. And it was like, yes, it's open book, open note. And what I didn't realize was in this class, open book, open note meant in the book, the answer is right here, basically. Find what I'm talking about and find me the answer. So what he did to make sure that the final test was a little bit more manageable is he added a single bonus question worth 20 points, told us what the question was in advance, told us what page of the textbook the answer was on, and so this would bring the average up from a 60 to an 80.
That's an attendance bonus is what that is.
Yeah. Well, I think he might have emailed it out. So that's how I got 106 on the final exam.
Nice.
And I say that's the worst one, but I actually think the real worst one was a computer science course I was in, which had been highly reviewed. All the students loved it. But we had a new teacher that quarter, and she seemed very nice. But basically, it was you didn't really have homework. You had take-home parts of a project. It was one of those computer science courses where they had a grading program that they would build, and then you'd plug your code into it, and they would grade you based on how well it worked. And, like, if it didn't compile, you would automatically get a zero. But if it did compile but didn't do what you needed, you could get, like, incremental scores. And you had about 2 weeks to do each thing. And then the next part of the project would be built on your code from the first part of the project. So your grade could only ever go down because you could like, if you didn't get perfect on the first week, then all of your code that built on that would be worse. Jeez. It was also all partner projects, and the guy who I was partnered with, great, very friendly, had some kind of horrible series of mishaps that quarter. So I ended up doing almost all of the work for all of it with no help or support. And basically by the end of the class, the teacher was like, I'm going to tell you what your letter grade will be, and then you can tell me if you want to take the class pass fail. We're not supposed to do this, but I'm going to do this. And it's like, you will be getting a C minus. And I was like, I'll take it pass fail. And she was like, great, then you're going to pass, but it's not going to contribute to your GPA. So that annoyed me the most. That was the least fair.
That sucks.
And I put up with too much in that class because it's like, it's a partner project that's already shitty.
Was this the class where you decided to not make CS your second major?
No, this is the class that inadvertently screwed me out of being able to have CS as my second major.
Got
in combination with my advisor not understanding the course requirements or not accurately communicating with them, because between our two meetings, she went from, yeah, you should be all set to be able to get your CS minor, to, oh, you actually needed to do this other series of courses to qualify for the CS minor. So you can't actually do it before you graduate. I still feel so bad. She was so nice, but she literally didn't know what she was talking about. And then when we graduated, they were like, hey, leave an anonymous review of your advisor for future students. And I was like, she's so nice, but I have to be honest, because otherwise some poor future student is going to have this worse, because I at least had the math major that I got through. But so college is a nightmare. Be honest in your reviews of classes and teachers. It's what those are for. You are saving your fellow students from issues.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry about that.
I'm trying to think. I have a whole bunch of various stories that were just not fun, but I don't know if it is best suited for the question. I have like bad overall class experiences where like the final exam is kind of like a microcosm of just the whole class. There was a summer Greek program at your university, Red, where the professor threatens to fail me over a B+. And stressed me out so much about the prospect of losing an entire summer and several thousand dollars worth of tuition that I developed an infection under my left eye from stress. That's great.
Also fucking ridiculous. A B plus at UChicago is like, that's excellent.
That's an A triple plus anywhere else, exactly.
Pretty much, yeah. UChicago doesn't do grade inflation. It's the one thing they have.
It's Greek. Get off my ass. What am I going to do, mispronounce something wrong to a native speaker of ancient Greek? I'll have to dig one up first. Other than that, though, I can go back to high school for not, like, the worst story, but, like, I don't even know what kind of story this is. I'll just tell it, and we'll all figure it out together.
Yay.
But it was seventh grade algebra, and I was not great at it. You know, enough to pass the class, but not by much. I would have taken that pass-fail offer, Red, if I was given it. I did the final exam, and I knew that I kind of boofed it. Like, I remember these problems very clearly. I don't know how I would have actually, like, gotten them. It was just bad. My brain was off that day. The rest of my finals went fine that week. It was just this algebra one just wrecked me. So I went home, talked to my dad, and I was like, yeah, I really didn't do that great. Like, I remember the problems. I didn't get them. And my dad, who is a very good mathematician, was like, tell me the problems. We'll work on them together. At least you can learn from them. I was like, okay, great. So we worked through the problems. We spent like, you know, 2-3 hours that night going through them, like learning, okay, like here's how we do this. Here's where I got stuck. Here's what you need to do. Oh, okay. So now that you know this, how would you solve the rest of it? And then I was able to do them and stuff. And it was a good little father-son moment. I went back to school the next day. The teacher had graded the exams and was like, listen, Blue, buddy. She called me that. It was weird that she called me Blue instead of my real name.
Very prescient.
You didn't do great. But I will give you the opportunity, if you want to take it again, I'll let you do it. And I said, listen, it wouldn't be fair. I went home and I worked through all the problems with my dad. I feel like I can in good conscience do that. And she said, you know what? Fair enough. I'll give you a little bit of a benefit. I'm going to weight it differently. Like, you're still going to get this number that you got, but like, I'm not going to have it ruin you. And she sent like this glowing email to my parents, like, thank you for raising such like an honest and upright young boy. And when I didn't have the heart to tell anybody, except the entire internet now, isn't that how YouTube works, is I was just so tired. I knew even having gone through with my dad and learned the problems, I was confident I still would have fucked it up even worse than on the original day. So I'm like, you know what? Gonna take the L so I don't get an even bigger L. Like, thank you, that's so sweet. I can't in good conscience do this, and I will do it worse.
Yeah.
I'm just so tired, I can't. That's
honestly
my story on that one.
That's good.
I don't know if that's a bad story or if that's like getting through a class by the, you know, skin of my teeth. I don't know what happened. It's just there's the story.
It's proof that honesty is the best policy, because even if you're kind of being dishonest about your honesty, sometimes shit like this happens.
I had to take the SATs an extra time because one time I took them, there was a like spelling error or something in the print for the instruction booklet. So through no fault of like the 100 or so kids who took it at my high school at the same time, they're like, hey, your scores from this one version of it's not gonna count. But that's not really a fun exam story, and also like we didn't know. I just took the SATs twice and got marginally the same score. When I was similarly in high school, there was a kid who used to sit behind me and copy off of my spelling quizzes, and it used to piss me off a lot because I'm a terrible speller. I notoriously can't spell things right, so I don't see how this was benefiting either of us. But I'm not very confrontational, so I wasn't gonna go tattle and I wasn't gonna confront the kid about it. So instead, about partway through the year, I just switched to writing in cursive instead of writing in print, and that solved the problem because he couldn't read my cursive and it changed nothing for me. I was still a terrible speller, so it really affected me in no way. But that got me into the habit of writing in cursive for a really long time. And this would be very normal for me until I hit college and I was in a a Chinese documentary class that was taught by a professor whose second language was English, and I had been answering all of these Blue Book written exams in my cursive English handwriting. And oh, one day after class, she like pulled me in the hallway. She's like, "I know that you're writing a lot, and what I can read is very good, but I do need to sit down with you and like have you translate just a few of these words out of cursive into print for me real quick. And if you could in the future write in print on exams, it'd be really appreciated." And I felt so bad. I was like, "I'm so sorry. I didn't even think about that. Like, this has just been a habit." She's like, "You're totally fine." Like, but it just like made me really glad that I had studied for that particular exam, because if that had been the one where I took the L, if I had to sit there and be like, "Wrong." Study for your tests. And cursive is a really fun lost art in many parts of the US that you can use to help keep people from cheating off of you, but also like be cognizant. Be smart about it.
Can I give an example of a gamer strat that one of my professors had for his tests?
Sure.
So basically the class was 4 assignments in total, 2 exams and 2 essays. It was a midterm and a final and 2 essays in between them. Mm-hmm. The way that the midterm works is that the midterm was hard as hell. It was brutal, and most people got like 50, 60, 70s. It was rough. And he says, all right, students, okay, scholars, here's the deal. You all did abysmally, but I'm going to cut you all a collective deal. If you do better on the final than you did on the midterm, I will pretend the midterm didn't happen. I will weight it so far down that it doesn't matter, and your final exam grade will be the only one that you get. And of course, there's 4 assignments in the whole semester, so like, why wouldn't you take that deal? So everyone studied their ass off for the final, and the final was dead easy. So he basically tricked everybody into doing really, really, and the final was cumulative too, so you went back on the stuff that you learned for the midterm. So he basically terrified everybody into studying their butt off, and then they all ended up getting great grades anyway, because weighted the midterm to 0 and the final to everything, and the final was easy, but everyone still studied really hard for it. Genius. He was a genius.
I have a old school grievance from like fucking 6th grade math homework that I might have already said.
Is this the lady who couldn't do fractions?
Yeah, this is the lady who graded our homework sheet with the wrong answer key and then attempted to double down on why her incorrect math was actually correct. And like, I have gotten better at understanding why people are stupid sometimes. In my old age, I have come to understand humanity a little better than I did when I was profoundly undersocialized, undiagnosed ADHD, and profoundly antisocial. But that was the wrong year to come at me with 1/2 + 1/2 should be a 1/4, actually. Like, I think back and I'm like, I must have been an absolute terror to those teachers, but also, fuck you for getting math wrong and trying to gaslight me. You deserve that shit. So,
Anyway. We are running a little long, but we've got time for one last question here. We have, obviously, you know, one thing that people never let go of is times you consider yourself wronged as a child in educational settings.
Yeah. Oh,
whether deserved or not, I'm not going to sit here and dictate that. But just, I've noticed as a person that that is something that no matter how old I get, me and my friends are still like, remember in the 6th grade when we were wronged by XYZ for this homework assignment that has affected us in 0 ways in our adulthood? But this last question, we're going to return to an old favorite of yours and mine, the time heist from Pearl Red King. To all, in order to appeal to a wider audience, you decide the OSP time heist, the movie, will be rated PG-13, meaning you're only allowed 1 F-bomb. Where would you put that F-bomb? To recap... The Time Heist is a series of wacky hijinks and adventures that Red and Blue and later cameos from the rest of the OSP crew come into with the help of such iconic heroes as Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, the Monkey King, and Tripitaka, traveling through time in some sort of Da Vinci-esque machine, doing things. And at some point in there, we do need to drop an F-bomb. So you tell me where
that
is.
I think there's a correct answer to this. But it requires setup that we haven't already done yet, which is one of the characters we pick up needs to speak no English at any point. It could be any of them because they're all from different points in history. I think one of the funniest options is if Sun Wukong never speaks English and is just like commenting on the goings-on, can understand everybody else, but is just speaking like an ancient form.
Like in Ocean's Eleven.
Yeah. And at some kind of climactic moment at the cusp of the third act, we're all staring up in horror at some rift opening in the sky, and he just goes, fuck! It's the only English word he says.
I think I'm on board with the character speaking a different language, except for the one F-bomb being pretty solid.
Yeah. It's just a matter of which character would be the funniest option for that.
Yeah. I mean, Da Vinci, I feel like if he's our, like, machine guy, inventor guy, constantly trying to explain these, like, complicated principles that he's traveling us through time with, could be good if it's all happening in, you know, whatever, Italian, right?
Is that technobabble? No, it's just Italian.
Yeah. I think the best option for that, actually, is that, like, he can speak English, but whenever he gets really into the technicals, he's, like, not sure what the words are, and he's like, and like, just launches into the full, like, fluent Italian explanation, and it's like, did you get that? And it's like, sure. Oh, man. Julius Caesar speaking Latin the entire time until, like, the dignified facade cracks for just a single F-bomb.
We're just reinventing Noir's bit from the Julius Caesar.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. It's good. It was a good bit. And it was you, a Brutus? Good bit.
Julius Caesar speaking fluent, perfect, reconstructed classical Latin the whole time, gets stabbed. Fuck.
Fuck you, Brutus.
Yeah, fuck you, Brutus.
The true villain of the Time Heist series.
We've all seen that Tumblr post where they basically managed to translate Kaisu Technon as "see you in hell, punk."
Yeah. I think the only alternative to what we've come up with so far, because that is very promising, would be, like, if we wanted to make it meta at all and, like, have it be one of us who drops the F-bomb, one of us should be constantly cursing and the other would be following them around with, like, a sensor, like a bleep button, and just, like, once they manage to get it in fast enough so that they can't hit the button in time and it skates through. But I don't like that as much as I like character speaking entirely a different language until they drop the one F-bomb.
This is like the George Clooney sensor bar in Spy Kids.
Yes. Yes, exactly that. Also, I did make Red and Blue watch Spy Kids.
We can talk more about that in the future.
I'll talk about that on the After Show. Perfect.
Yeah. That was a highlight for me. But yes, no, I think that we are sort of reinventing the George Clooney sensor bar from Spy Kids in that particular version.
And that's okay. That's what it deserves.
Yeah. It's all good.
I think the answer is that there's no world where the Time Heist is PG-13 because it is much funnier if we can do whatever we want.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
It's like there's no version of which character in Lord of the Rings says the F-bomb that isn't hilarious. Every option is perfect.
Mm-hmm. Fucking habits.
But all right, fuck your secrets. But in this case, I think, like, A, lacking a script that we can easily refer to makes the bit a little harder to improvise. But I think it's funny if they're like a million swears, but it's all in the different languages different characters are speaking.
Oh my god. I have you know what? More after social content. I've been fucking agonizing about how to do a proper fantasy swear that has the same impact as what the hell? Because, like, you know what? We'll get into it then. We'll get into it then. I think Julius Caesar drops the F-bomb.
One immediate thought is that is incredibly funny to have different swear words in different languages. How we could, if we could tightly script it so that every character says the F-bomb once, but in their equivalent language, that only has to get censored once per release per region, still technically qualifies.
Done. Genius. Perfect. Genius. That's it.
Great. Well, that's the podcast. So, Blue, you want to take us out?
Blue? Why was Blue taking us out?
Or Red, or whoever.
Why not?
I don't know.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. I have usurped Red and I cannot be stopped. We'll be back in another 2 weeks with special guest JM8 of Second Wind. If you want to ask a question for him, throw it into the Ask OS Pod channel. If you are a patron, hop over to Patreon or fire up your little app, Doohickey, and listen to that. RSS feeds are a thing too. Who cares? I've been Blue.
And they say I do a bad job on the outro.
I literally almost called myself Red just through force of habit of how that line read usually goes.
I cannot be
replaced.
And
this has been an Overly Sarcastic Podcast.
I'm haunting the narrative.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of the Overly Sarcastic Podcast. We'll be back on June 2nd with another thrilling installment. But if you miss us before then, be sure to check out Overly Sarcastic Productions on YouTube. Got a question for the pod? Head over to Ask OS Pod on Discord for a chance for your question to be featured in a future episode. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. And if you really enjoyed the show, consider becoming a patron for even more exclusive benefits. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.